good. So let's begin by cultivating our motivation. And since part of refuge guidelines is to begin each activity by taking refuge, then let's remember our refuge before we listen to the teachings, so that we're clear on our spiritual direction. We're following the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And then being clear on our refuge, then let's practice what the Buddha, as our teacher, taught. And one of the chief things that he taught is to cultivate the loving, compassionate thought of bodhicitta. So let's remember this as our motivation for listening together and sharing the Dharma, that we really want to be of the greatest benefit, the most long-term benefit to each and every sentient being. And so therefore we're aspiring for full enlightenment. Okay, so today is the last talk in this particular series, and so we'll finish up the topic of refuge this evening. So there's two more kind of topics within refuge that I'd like to talk about. One is the benefit of taking refuge, and then the other is taking refuge by knowing the distinguishing features of the three jewels. So let's talk about the benefit of taking refuge first. And so in the Lam Rim it lists 8 benefits. You might be able to think of more, but it's good to contemplate the benefits of taking refuge, because that inspires us to really contemplate the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and to deepen our faith and our refuge in them. You know, because whenever we see the benefits of doing something, then we want to do it. Okay? So that's why a lot of Lam Rim topics start off with talking about the benefits, because our spiritual masters are kind of giving us the sales pitch about why this topic is something good that we want to realize. Okay? So let's listen to the sales pitch about taking refuge. And if you listen well, for sure you're going to want to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Okay, so first benefit is we become a Buddhist. Okay, in other words, we become a follower of Buddha. We are linked into that stream, that chain of practitioners that started with an enlightened teacher and passed down to us. So, you know, the refuge that we take is really in our heart, but especially when we do it in a ceremony with a teacher, then we're making a public statement, and we really get that sense of joining in to the Buddhist family. But these benefits of taking refuge accrue whether we take refuge in a formal ceremony or not. It's just, in a formal ceremony, you get the extra added perk. It's kind of like you can live with somebody for a long time, but when you get married, something special happens because you're doing a public ceremony. Okay, so if we don't take refuge sincerely, then the merit, the positive potential we create, won't be directed towards the goals that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha direct us in. You know, because if our refuge is in some other path, or if we don't have any kind of refuge except the 8 worldly concerns, then, you know, our energy gets put in those directions, and either we don't create any merit, or if we do, it isn't directed towards the goals that the Triple Gem set forth. The second benefit of taking refuge is that it establishes the foundation for taking all further vows. Okay? And so before you take the 5 precepts, or the one-day vows, or monastic precepts, or bodhisattva precepts, or tantric precepts, all of those other precepts are taken on the basis of taking refuge. Okay? So I did say yesterday that on that Lama Zopa got special permission from Chichen Rinpoche for people who hadn't formally taken refuge and become Buddhists to do the Mahayana precepts. So that's kind of an exception. But otherwise, to really be able to take any kind of precepts, we need the foundation of refuge first. Because, you know, by taking refuge, then we want to follow the guidelines that the Buddha set forth. If we don't have that refuge and confidence in the three jewels, then the motivation to follow the guidelines that they set forth is missing, because we don't really trust the path that they're describing. But on the other hand, if our refuge is really strong, and we have very strong confidence in the ability of the three jewels to lead us to liberation and enlightenment, then we won't back off from the ethical guidelines that they prescribed, because we'll really understand that those ethical guidelines were stated by people, you know, by the Buddha, who's omniscient and sees, you know, clearly, you know, through his clairvoyant powers, what the cause of happiness and the cause of suffering are. And so then we'll really trust the ethical precepts that we've taken, if we trust the Buddha who set them forth. Okay? Communicating? Yeah. I should also say that, you know, not only refuge, the ethical precepts are taken on the basis of refuge, but actually everything is done on the basis of refuge. And if we lack refuge, we may do meditations that resemble the Buddhist meditations, but they won't bring about the result that the Buddha taught, because we aren't completely convinced in the Buddhist path, because we haven't taken refuge in it. Okay? So, for example, a practice like calm abiding or serenity, you know, the meditation that we do to develop concentration, this meditation is also non-Buddhists do it. Okay, and they do it because you get an extremely blissful mind from generating single-pointedness, and they, you know, actualize that, and, you know, actualize the jhanas and the form realm absorptions. And because they don't have refuge in the three jewels, and they aren't paying attention to the Buddha's instructions when he said, you know, don't just generate concentration, also meditate on the nature of reality, also cultivate special insight. So because they haven't listened to those instructions, because they haven't taken refuge, then they cultivate those deep samadhis and they get reborn in those realms. But then when that karma runs out, then they're reborn again in unfortunate places or as a human being. But, you know, their concentration doesn't lead them to enlightenment. Similarly, people can do tantric meditations. You know, there's Hindu tantra, and it has mantras and it has visualizations, and they also meditate on the channels, winds and drops. And they also practice, you know, dissolving the winds and do all these yogic exercises. And all of that is done in Hindu tantra, okay? So if you do all these practices, but you don't have refuge in the three jewels, then you're not going to actualize the aim of the tantric meditations as the Buddha set them forth. Yeah, because you're not doing Buddhist tantra, you're doing non-Buddhist tantra, because you don't have refuge. Yeah, and so without refuge, then you're not going to have any inclination to understand emptiness. And without the understanding of emptiness, you can, you know, do powa all you want. You can, you know, say all the mantras you want to. You can do all sorts of things. But if we lack a proper understanding and lack refuge, then we won't get the result that the Buddha set forth. So refuge in the three jewels is really important for all the other practices that we're going to embark on. So if we want to, you know, we kind of think, oh, tantra sounds good, I want to take tantric initiations, but we don't want to take refuge, then we should ask ourselves why. You know, how is it that we're thinking that we want to do these high practices the Buddha prescribed, but we don't trust the Buddha enough to take refuge and, you know, and to take precepts? You get what I mean? It's like something's out of order here. Okay, then the third benefit of taking refuge is that it helps us to purify our negative karma. And so when we take refuge, again, you know, we will really want to do what the Buddha said. And we, so therefore, we change our outlook on life. We learn about the law of karma and its results. And we have, you know, some confidence that those karmic actions bring certain results, because the Buddha described that. And so therefore, when we look at our life and see the negative actions we were involved in, we really develop some aspiration to purify them and to engage in those purification practices. And so that's how taking refuge leads to our purifying our negative karma. And then the fourth benefit of taking refuge is that it helps us quickly accumulate a great deal of positive karma, positive potential or virtue or merit, whatever you want to call it. And the reason for this is, again, when we trust the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, we follow their instructions, their wise guidelines. And the Buddha taught all these practices, such as making offerings and meditating on bodhicitta and doing volunteer work and, you know, doing acts of kindness. He taught all of those. And so because we've taken refuge in the Buddha and trust his guidance, then we will do those practices. And by doing them, then we accumulate a whole lot of positive karma. So that's one way that refuge helps us to accumulate positive karma. Another way is that the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are very strong objects with which to create good karma because of the level of their realizations. Yeah, and so when we create positive potential in relation to them, that positive potential becomes very strong. And so that's why there's the practice of making offerings to our spiritual mentors and to the three jewels. That's why there's the practice of, you know, bowing to the three jewels. Why there's the practice of offering service, you know, to the Sangha community and to the three jewels. Because they're a very, very strong object with which we can create positive karma. Yeah, because of you know, the Buddha's Dharma and Sangha, their realizations. And so, therefore, it becomes easy for us to create good karma in relationship to them. If we don't have confidence in them, then, you know, when we make offerings, we're going to make offering to whoever is our object of attachment. And then, you know, it's nice, but it's not quite the same as making offerings to the three jewels. Okay, because chances are our motivation is going to be different when we make offerings to our objects of attachment. Okay, then the fifth benefit of taking refuge is that we can't be harmed by humans or non-humans. Yeah. So what that means is that, you know, you might say, well, how come, you know, I can't be harmed by humans or spirits if I take refuge? Well, one of the reasons is, again, if we take refuge, then we practice the Buddha's instructions, so we stop creating negative karma and we purify the negative karma we've already created. When we do that, then other living beings can't harm us. Okay, because we haven't created the cause for it. Also, when we practice the Dharma under refuge, then we become a nicer, kinder person, and so other people, you know, we won't push their buttons and make them mad so much. And so clearly we won't be harmed by them in return because, you know, we'll be nicer people to be around with. And so the same thing happens in terms of spirits and, you know, certain spirit afflictions. If we don't create the karma for that, or if we purify any karma we may have created for it, then spirits can't harm us. Yeah, so spirit as well, I mean, it's the same as with any other living being. They only have the door to harm because of our negative mind and our karma. Okay, but if we practice the Dharma and don't create the karma and begin to control our mind, then, you know, they don't have the space to act. And also, you know, if you ever have the sensation that you have some, you know, some spirit affliction or something like that, taking refuge is a very, very good method to deal with it. Even if you have bad dreams, you know, and nightmares, whether they're due to spirits or probably not, then if you wake up from your nightmare and you take refuge, then, you know, all the fear in the nightmare completely evaporates. You know, so some people tell me that sometimes, you know, they'll have the sensation of something or pressing down on them. You know, when I'm in Southeast Asia, because people have that mentality of thinking about spirits, then they'll say, oh, I was falling asleep and, you know, I had the sensation of somebody pressing down on me, or, you know, I was depressed, but there wasn't any real reason why I was mentally unhappy. Maybe there was some spirit interference there. So I always tell these people that if that happens, then it's very important to take refuge, because then, you know, as soon as you take refuge and you're thinking of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, your whole mental attitude changes, yeah? And you have a very positive mental attitude. With that positive mental attitude, you know, and negative forces can't affect you. Yeah? So negative forces only affect us because of our, what the Tibetans call namtok, our superstitious thoughts, our preconceptions. Yeah. So there's this story of Milarepa in the cave, and all these spirits came to disturb him, and he said, why are you here? How come you came to bother me? And they said, well, you called us. All your, you know, preconceptions and superstitious thoughts, they're the ones that invoked us here. Okay, so it's the same if we have that kind of superstitious mentality. And by superstitious, it doesn't mean, you know, black cats and walking under ladders and things like that. Lama Yeshe used the expression superstitious thoughts to refer to, let's say, our grasping at inherent existence, our attachment and clinging on to sense objects, our conviction that some other person is a real enemy and we have to destroy them, you know. So those are also examples of our superstitious thoughts. Okay, then the sixth benefit of taking refuge is that we won't fall to unfortunate rebirths. Okay, so part of this is because, you know, we'll have purified karma and not created the karma for an unfortunate rebirth. But also, if at the time of death we take rebirth, I mean, sorry, if at the time of death we take refuge, then, you know, again, like in the previous thing, our mind is automatically in a very positive, uplifted state. In that positive, uplifted state of thinking about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, then there's no opportunity for negative karma to ripen. Okay, because the mind's in a positive state. So without that negative karma ripening, then, you know, we're not going to get the lower rebirth right away. And also, that works because if we take refuge at the time of death, because our mind is making a connection with the Buddha, okay, we're kind of tuning in to the Buddha when we take refuge. We're making that connection. Then by the power of the Buddha, or by the power of our connection with the Buddha, it becomes impossible to be reborn in the lower realms in that very next life. Okay? Because our mind is really in such a good state. And so that's why it's so important for us to really practice taking refuge now, and practice taking refuge in every single situation that we encounter. Because if we set up that habit of taking refuge, then when death comes, and we don't know when it's going to come, we'll have that habit, and so we'll just take refuge and, you know, reap the benefits of taking refuge. Whereas if we don't establish that habit of taking refuge now, then at the time of death, you know, we'll revert to all of our old habits. And what do we usually do in our life with our old habits when we're afraid? You know, we fall into panic, we fall into fear, we blame other people, we curse, we get angry, you know. And so who in the world wants to die with those kind of mental states? You know, what kind of karma is going to ripen if we fall into our old deluded, afflicted habits of how we deal with discomfort and pain? It's not going to be a good trip, you know. But if we take refuge, then the mind's turned in a different direction. And we can, you know, die very peacefully and have a positive karma ripen. Okay, then the seventh benefit of taking refuge is that our, in general, our virtuous aspirations will be fulfilled, and also our, you know, many of our temporal goals will be fulfilled. And so, you know, again, this comes about because of having made the connection with the Buddha, and also because of following the Buddha's instructions about karma. Yeah? And so, you know, when we follow a reliable guide that teaches us what the causes of happiness and the causes of suffering are, and that's what refuge induces us to do, is to follow that reliable guide, then we create the causes for our temporal goals and our ultimate goals to be successful. Okay? And then also, you know, that's kind of one reason why before we do any virtuous practice or any we start any new activity, we take refuge, we do prostrations, we make offerings, because doing that gives us a lot of confidence to be able to carry out the new activity that we're embarking upon. Okay? So before, you know, signing the contract to purchase the abbey, some of you may have been at the retreat, and we were taking refuge and chanting mantra and generating bodhicitta and everything else, you know, as a way of creating a lot of virtue, so that the abbey could start off on good, you know, a good feet. And so that's why, you know, before you break ground on doing a new building, or before you start, you know, any big, you know, big thing in your Dharma center or in your life, then we take refuge, we make prostrations, we make offerings to the Triple Gem, we make request prayers. And if we do that, you know, things will turn out well because our mind is in such a positive state. Okay, so before beginning the work on the gazebo, you know, where we're going to, or our former gazebo, we had to take it down, but we're going to be putting a bust of the Buddha there. Then, you know, before starting that work, then we should take refuge and, you know, prostrations and offerings and everything as a way of really directing our mind in a good way so that we can accomplish that. Okay, then the eighth benefit of taking refuge is that we will quickly attain Buddhahood by taking the essence of our precious human life. Okay? So refuge, you know, is the foundation for practicing all the other practices that will enable us to attain Buddhahood quickly. So that's a big benefit of taking refuge. Okay, so understanding those benefits, then we really want to take refuge again and again. And we want to take refuge not just from the mouth, but really from the depths of our heart. And we can feel the difference in our Dharma practice when we take refuge from the mouth and when we take it in our hearts. Yeah, there's a very distinct feeling between the two things. In the same way that there's a distinct feeling between when we say the four immeasurables with our mouth and when we actually feel them. Okay? So, let's return to the third Dalai Lama's text, The Essence of Refined Gold, and I want to read the last paragraph in the refuge section there. So he said, with awareness of the need to avoid wasting time on mere words, recite the following refuge formula 3 times each day and 3 times each night. So it's good to do in the morning and in the evening. Namo Guruvya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya. While doing so, maintain awareness of the unsurpassed qualities of the three jewels and of their individual uniqueness and the commitments. Okay, so while we say Namo Guruvya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, we are aware of the unsurpassed qualities of the three jewels. So we talked about those in previous talks in this series. We also talked about the commitments in the last 2 talks. So we want to be mindful of those. And then now we're going to talk about the individual uniqueness of the three jewels, okay, or their distinguishing features. Okay. Because sometimes a question may come, well, each of the three jewels has so many qualities, so is it okay just to take refuge in one? Why do we need to think about all three? Okay, and the answer is, you know, all three are different because they each have their own unique qualities. And by understanding their qualities, we take refuge in each jewel in a slightly different way. Okay? And so there's 6 different qualities that we're going to go through and see how we relate to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha in terms of each one of these. Okay, so the first quality we're going to look at is the characteristics. Yeah, so we take refuge in the Buddha by seeing him as the one who has abandoned all defects and developed all good qualities. We take refuge in the Buddha seeing, you know, understanding that he can see the two truths simultaneously and very clearly. That he is, you know, any Buddha is omniscient. We take refuge in the Dharma by understanding the Dharma's unique characteristics. Okay, so that's the Dharma is the true cessation and the true cessations, plural, and true paths. And they are what the Buddha taught to meet the needs of sentient beings and to fulfill the spiritual aspirations and purposes of the sentient beings. Okay, and so we take refuge in the Dharma, seeing that teaching the Dharma is the whole reason why the Buddha appeared in the world. Okay, and that it's the Dharma that actually frees us. And then we take refuge in the Sangha, understanding their characteristics, that they're the ones who have realized the Dharma. In other words, they have understood emptiness directly and non-conceptually, and so they can give us accurate guidance so that we can generate that same realization of the lack of inherent existence. And the Sangha also prove the validity and the usefulness of everything that the Buddha taught. Okay, so, you know, when we look at the example that the Arya Sangha give us, or we look at the example of a monastic community where people are keeping their vows well, we get inspired because they're practicing what the Buddha taught. And so they show us that it's possible to transform our mind and also that it's beneficial to transform our mind. Okay? I remember one friend of mine who is a Thai monk, when he before he, you know, knew anything about Buddhism, he was lying on the beaches in Thailand. He's British, so he was, you know, indulging in all the sense pleasures on the Thai beaches. And then he went up to Wat Phananachat, which is one of Achan Cha's centers, and you know, and where a lot of the Sangha resided, especially the Western Sangha. And so he got there, and here are all these monastics living in, you know, over 200 precepts. And at first his mind is going, why do they have so many rules? They can't do this and they can't do that, and they're so restricted, you know. And then, you know, because that's our usual Western viewpoint towards such things. And then he realized as he stayed there that here are all these people with all these rules, but they were much happier than he was. And, you know, they were kind of happy, relaxed, content people. And, you know, here he was kind of running around, searching for sense pleasure, getting angry at people, being dissatisfied. And so just by the example of the Sangha community, you know, then that gave him some guidance as to what he needed to practice. Okay, so the characteristics is the first of the you know, the six criteria here that we're looking at. Then the second one is how we take refuge by seeing their unique qualities in terms of their enlightening influence. Okay, so the Buddha's enlightening influence is enacted by his giving the verbal teachings, sometimes it's called the scriptural teachings, and also by his embodiment of the realizational dharma, okay, which means the actual realizations. And so the Buddha is the one who, you know, instructs us what to practice and what to abandon. And the Buddha transmits the dharma in the most effective way for our kind of personality, with our disposition and our interest. So that's, we take refuge in the Buddha, knowing that, you know, that that's how his enlightening influence is enacted. Then we take refuge in the Dharma because their enlightening influence, in other words, how the true paths and true cessations function in terms of influencing us in an enlightening way, is by they eliminate all the afflictions and dukkha, all the suffering. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we say that the Dharma is the real refuge, because when it's in our mind, then there's you know, no cause. It eliminates the causes of suffering and the actual dukkha itself. And then the enlightening influence, the Sangha, is enacted by the Sangha giving us encouragement. They give us a role model. They give us inspiration and assistance in practicing the Dharma. And so by knowing that there's a Sangha community, or that there are individual Sangha members who have the direct realization of emptiness, then we know that we're not alone on the spiritual path. And that is very important for us, you know, to know that others have gone before us having practiced this path and gotten the results, and so we can rely on their guidance. And you know, His Holiness talks about that, because he says sometimes we think of the Buddha and the Buddha just seems so far away. You know, like, how am I ever going to become like a Buddha? But if we look at the Sangha community, you know, then it's like, okay, well, they're kind of a little bit ahead of me. I can kind of, you know, start to approach where they're getting to. Yeah? And so, you know, or if we... you know, so that sets a role model for us and gives us some inspiration. Okay, then the third distinguishing feature of, you know, the Buddha Dharma Sangha is in terms of the aspirations or the fervent regard that we have for each one of them. Okay, and so with respect to the Buddha, our aspiration is... you know, is or the fervent regard is we have a lot of devotion and respect for the Buddha. We have a lot of gratitude for the Buddha appearing in the world and giving the teachings. And we show our respect and gratitude to the Buddha for all the help that he's given by giving the teachings, by offering, by making offerings, by making prostrations, by being of service to two groups that, you know, spread the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, so that's a way that we, you know, show our gratitude or our fervent regard. So this may involve, you know, for example, making donations to build a place for the Buddha. In other words, building a temple. Yeah, or giving donations to send Dharma books to inmates, or to publish Dharma books for free distribution. So it's a way of showing our gratitude to the Buddha for all of his help. Okay, and then our aspirations towards the Dharma are, we aspire to put it into practice. We practice the Dharma and use it to transform our minds, and that's our way of showing our gratitude and respect and fervent regard for the Dharma. Okay, so we don't just do a lot of worship, and they're the texts of the Kangyur and Tengyur, and I make offerings to them. No, we need to practice what's written inside of those texts. Okay, and that's how we really show our respect and regard for the Dharma. And then showing our fervent regard for the Sangha is, we practice together with them. Okay? So, you know, we go to a monastery and practice together with the Sangha. Or if there's somebody who's realized emptiness, we practice it with that person. Or we go to a Dharma center and we practice with the greater Buddhist community. Okay, and so what we're doing in terms of the Sangha is, we're joining them in our efforts to practice the Dharma and to spread the Dharma and to make the Dharma a living force in the minds and lives of other sentient beings. Okay, so we want to share the Dharma with other people, not because we want everybody to become a Buddhist, because then when they take the census, they'll say that we're the fastest growing religion and my religion's best and everybody will be on my team. That's not the reason we share the Dharma. We share the Dharma because we know from our own experience how beneficial it is when you learn it and practice it. And we want other sentient beings to have that benefit. And so I'm always eternally grateful to the people who put the flyers about meditation classes in bookstores and tea stores, send out announcements and things like that, because that's how I met the Dharma. Yeah, I met the Dharma through seeing a flyer in Bodhi Tree Bookstore in Los Angeles in 1975. Okay, so somebody, you know, was practicing very well and put out these flyers, and look what happened to me because of it. Yeah, so, you know, we can really see that's the benefit of wanting to share the Dharma with others. Okay, then the fourth quality is how we practice in terms of each of the three jewels. So, the Buddha is the model for what we want to become, and so we practice in relation to the Buddha by making offerings, making prostrations, generating the minds that make us closer to the Buddha, and we, you know, show our respect to the Buddha as a way of making our mind more receptive to the Dharma teachings and to practicing the Dharma teachings. Okay, so again, we're not just talking about worship here. Okay, the practice, you know, any kind of ritual or prostrations or offerings, you know, these things are common in all the Buddhist traditions. They all have rituals and bowing and offerings. But the whole purpose of that is to open our mind and set the stage for us taking the Buddhist teachings into our lives and practicing them and using them to transform our minds. Okay? So we're not doing these rituals and other things just for the sake of doing them or to win the Buddha's favor because the Buddha will like us because, We gave him some Oreo cookies and a peach tonight. You know, it's not like that, okay? It's because these practices really help our own mind. Okay? The way we practice in terms of the Dharma is we meditate on the path. And we integrate the path with our body, speech, and mind. Because remember, the Dharma jewel is the true paths and the true cessations. So that's how we practice in terms of them, by meditating on them. You know, hearing, thinking, and meditating, I should say. And then we practice in terms of the Sangha by practicing harmoniously together with the Sangha, sharing the teachings, sharing material possessions, following the example of the Sangha. So in a monastic community, everybody shares in the offerings equally. Yeah, the fully ordained people share in the offerings equally. So they share in the material possessions. They share the precepts. They share the teachings. They share the practice. And so that's how you really practice with the Sangha community, because, you know, instead of it just being, you know, I want to do this practice, so I don't want to practice with you because I want to sit in my room and do this practice, and I feel like doing this, and, you know, where shall I go to practice the Dharma so that it's good for my Dharma practice? Yeah, instead of just being so focused on, you know, how can my Dharma practice get ahead, we become really focused on sharing the Dharma with the community. Yeah, and you know, we create so much more positive potential when we practice together with the community. You know, it's like sweeping a room with a brick, with a broom, versus with a you know, one little strand of something. Okay, then so that was the fourth quality. Then the fifth quality that we're going to know, this distinguishing difference of the three jewels, is what qualities to remember or what qualities to be mindful of when we reflect on them. So when we are mindful of the Buddha, we want to remember that he is free from the three poisons, from ignorance, anger, and attachment, that he has full wisdom, full compassion, omniscient mind, and that the Buddha is the perfect guide to lead us to full enlightenment. Okay, so when we recollect the qualities of the Buddha, this is what we want to hold in mind. When we recollect the Dharma, we want to remember that it brings good results in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end. You know? And we can see that as we practice the Dharma. At the beginning, you know, the Dharma, you know, can it brings, you know, sometimes we really get quite a high at the beginning, you know, because it's like we, you know, things click and we feel like, wow, here's finally something that's speaking to my heart. And, you know, the Buddha really understood what I was thinking, and he put it into words, and he's showing me a way to deal with it. And, you know, we really feel the good result in the middle, in the beginning. And then as we practice the Dharma, maybe that instant kind of rush goes away, but we begin to see some gradual progress in our mind, you know? And so we remember the good results that the Dharma brings in the middle of our practice. And then finally, at the end of our practice, you know, sometime when we're attaining the bhumis, the grounds and stages and full enlightenment, then, you know, we'll really see the advantages of the Dharma, because our mind will be completely one with the Dharma. There won't be a difference between the Dharma and our mind. Okay, and then in terms of the Sangha, the qualities that we remember are that they follow the right path, and that they're practicing the Eightfold Noble Path, that they're impartial, that they're true friends for us, and that they provide good companionship for us on the path. Yeah, and so, you know, some of us have real issues with trust, you know, and we find it very difficult to trust others. And Drong Dompa said, rather than trust sentient beings, put our trust in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Because, you know, when we trust sentient beings, well, how much can sentient beings really fulfill our trust? Because they're under the influence of afflictions and karma. So they may want to do something and be unable to do it. They may tell us one thing and not be able to carry it out. Their minds are changeable. Their minds get overwhelmed by afflictions and they're moody and everything else. So rather than place our refuge in sentient beings who are not a stable refuge and cannot lead us to enlightenment, you know, and often, you know, it's hard to even count on them when we have worldly problems, then, you know, instead of placing ultimate refuge in sentient beings, to really put our refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. You know, because the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha won't abandon us. You know, it's much more likely that we abandon them, but they won't abandon us. Now, you might say, well, how do I know that? And what does that mean, that to place trust in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Well, for example, you know, as we age, we begin to see that we're losing our youth, we're getting older, our body doesn't function so well, we're getting more forgetful, you know. We start looking and seeing, oh, you know, I'm X number of years old, more than half of my life is gone, even if I live a normal lifespan, and I might not, you know, I might die sooner before that. And so we become concerned about what's going to happen to us in old age. Okay. Now, if you are a worldly person, what do you do with that worry and fear that you have of what's going to happen to you in old age? Yeah, you buy an insurance policy, you get a 401k, you have an IRA, you have kids and then talk them into taking care of you and hope that they actually do that. You do a lot of different things to try and establish some security for yourself in old age. But, you know, all those things that we do, it's not sure that you know, they'll be around when we need them in old age. You know, the money could have disappeared before that. The kids could have disappeared. Our friends could be busy, you know. So all those things, we may take refuge in worldly things, but we don't have any security that they're going to come through for us in old age. Yeah? So, but if we think about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and take refuge in them, okay, then rather than spending our youth, you know, chasing after this pleasure and after that pleasure and doing this and that and the other thing, we're going to spend all our energy practicing the Dharma. And when we have, you know, very strong refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we practice well, then we don't need to be afraid at old age. Because then even our body is weak. You know, we still know we have a precious human life and our mind is active. And, you know, you can be ill, you can be injured, but you can lie in that bed and still create good karma and generate bodhicitta and meditate on emptiness and, you know, practice the tantra. And you have lots to do when you're an old person. You're not just going to be stuck in front of the television, you know. And even if we wind up in an old folks home, you know, we can practice the Dharma and we know that we'll have some control over our mind as an old person. And then even if we get dementia and Alzheimer's, at least we'll be a kind person with dementia and Alzheimer's. You know, because if we practice the Dharma while we're young, then those are the kinds of mental habits that we establish. And then even when we're out of it, you know, we're still very kind to other people. Those of you who are DFFers, you know Miriam. And Miriam, I don't know how old she is now, maybe 85 or something. And, you know, she has dementia, but she is so sweet and loving, you know. And it's because she, you know, cultivated those traits when she was younger. And she did that because she had some refuge and some trust in the three jewels, okay? So, you know, it's this thing of, you know, there's some moments in your life where you have to jump and trust the three jewels. Because if you're always trying to make sure that your worldly life is taken care of completely adequately before you do anything, then you're never going to have the time to practice. Because there's always one more thing that you have to do to make your worldly life secure. And there's no end to it. But, you know, I mean, for example, you know, I was ordained when I was 24. Okay, I didn't have any money. I had maybe a few $100 in savings, and that was it. And here I was, you know, I'm ordaining, and one of our vows is not to do business. And so, you know, I interpreted that as I am not going to work for money, and I don't care what happens to me, I'm not working for money. And the Buddha said that if you practice sincerely, you're not going to starve. Okay, and so here I was going off to India. There's no abbey that supports me. There's no anybody that supports me. There are one or two friends who gave me a little bit. And I just, he said, well, the Buddha said this, and I trust what the Buddha said, that you're not going to starve. And so, you know, I haven't starved, and it's 30 years later. And I've never gone out and gotten a job. Yeah? And so, you know, I trust what the Buddha said in that respect. Yeah, I mean, there's been times when I've been very poor, but I've never starved. Yeah, what the Buddha said was true. So, I mean, there's just times in your life where you just have to jump and do what you need to do for your spiritual practice from your heart. And just, you know, because otherwise, you know, looking at it from the worldly point of view, you can't do anything. I mean, like even starting the abbey, if I was trying to get everything secure in a worldly way before starting the abbey, we wouldn't have an abbey right now. Yeah? Because when I signed those purchase papers, you know, we didn't have enough money. We had enough money for the down payment, and that was it when we were taking out a mortgage. And, you know, I had no idea how we were going to pay that mortgage off. Yeah, but I made prayers to Tara and the mortgage got paid off. Yeah, and so there's times when you just have to kind of trust the three jewels and trust your, you know, your virtuous intention, and the Buddha's going to support your virtuous intention. Okay, then the sixth quality of refuge is how we gain merit or positive potential in relationship to each. So we, in terms of the Buddha, we create merit and positive potential by taking refuge, making prostrations, making offerings to Shakyamuni Buddha and also all the other Buddhas. We create merit in relationship to the Dharma by developing it in our mind stream, because as we practice the Dharma, our mind gets transformed into virtue. That's how we create virtue or merit. And then we create merit or positive potential in relationship to the Sangha by doing virtuous activities together with them. Okay? And so we practice together. We do our meditation together. We do prostrations together. We listen to teachings together. We go and do social service together. We work together in the Dharma Center. We work together in the monastery. Yeah, we do things together. And so we are creating virtuous activities with members of this group. And that's very, very important. Yeah, because when we join a group for a specific purpose, we create the merit, the karma that group is creating by fulfilling their purpose, you know, even if we're not doing it. Okay, so if you become, let's say, a soldier to, you know, with your term to go kill the enemy, then even you're not the person who does that, because you join that group with that purpose. You accumulate that karma when other people do it. If you join a spiritual community, then when people there are doing virtuous practices, you know, you're part of that community and you're endorsing their purpose. And so you're automatically rejoicing in what they're doing, and so that creates a lot of positive potential. And then also we create merit in relationship to the Sangha by making offerings to them and by showing our respect to them. Yeah, and so that's a very important way to create positive potential. Yeah. Sometimes in the West, I think we have difficulty with that because, you know, we look at Asian Buddhists who go to the monastery and make offerings and we say, oh, they're just, you know, going to the monastery and making offerings because they're trying to earn merit for a good future life. And that's just, you know, a temporal aim, you know, a good future life in samsara. So I don't do it with that kind of bad motivation. And so then we don't make offerings to the Sangha at all. You know, so we're shooting, you know, do you see what we're doing? It's like, so we're shooting ourselves in the foot, you know, because you can make offerings to the Sangha with the aspiration for full enlightenment. And if you do that, you create incredible positive potential. Yeah. And so, you know, the Sangha, because they're practicing virtue, when you make offerings, it really enriches your mind. Because the people are going to use your offerings in a virtuous way for a good purpose. Okay, so those are the ways of taking refuge by knowing the unique qualities or the distinguishing features of each of the three jewels. So, we have a couple of minutes left for questions. There weren't any written questions. Any of you here have questions? Well, okay, in the absence of questions, then what I recommend for you to do is, you know, in your meditation, to do the analytic meditation or checking meditation on the benefits of taking refuge. So really thinking about these different points and how all these benefits come about from taking refuge, really try and understand how that works. And by doing that, then develop a lot of aspiration and vigor to take refuge. Okay, so do that meditation on the benefits of taking refuge. And then similarly, go through what we just talked about here about the unique qualities of the three jewels. Okay, so their unique characteristics, the uniqueness of each of the three jewels in terms of their enlightening influence, the fervent regard for them, how we practice in terms of each, how we remember or are mindful of each, and how we create positive potential in relationship to each one. Okay, so go through your notes on them or listen to the teaching again and reflect on that. And 'cause when you do, then that helps you know how to take refuge in them and how to use your refuge so that it really benefits your Dharma practice. Okay. Oh, so somebody here has a question. Yes.
I have a question on something I missed.
Okay.
And it was this last part, and it was the qualities to remember or reflect on. Could you just mention the ones in the Buddha again?
Okay. So the qualities. I mentioned six qualities in terms of each of the three jewels. So there was the characteristics, the enlightening influence, the fervent regard, how we practice, what qualities we remember, and how merit is gained. So the fifth one, what qualities to remember, what the qualities of the Buddha to remember, is that the Buddha is free from the three poisons, that he has full wisdom and compassion, that the Buddhas are omniscient, and that they can guide us to enlightenment. Okay, she was asking a question about what she missed in her notes. Okay, so we're concluding this series of teleteachings that we've been doing all May, and we've covered the section on refuge in the Essence of Refined Gold. So we will start the tele-teachings again, up again, 2 weeks from Thursday, which is May 14th. June 14th, yes, June 14th. And we'll have 5 Thursdays in a row. So we won't be doing Tuesday, just on Thursdays. And we will start on that series of tele-teachings talking about the law of karma and its results. So if you have the, and you all should have, the text for the Essence of Refined Gold, I believe we sent it out to everybody. If you didn't get it, write us and we will. And then you can print that out and you can go ahead and read this whole section on karma in preparation. And you might also want to read something about karma in any of the Lam Rim books. Says that'll just, you know, give you a little jump start on thinking about karma. And then also in these 2 intervening weeks, go back through all the teachings that we've heard on refuge. And as you review them, you know, now that you've heard the whole series on refuge, when you go back and review them, a lot more fits into place because you have, you know, you've heard much more about it. So you understand better what refuge is. Okay. So let's dedicate. And then remember before you go to sleep and when you wake up in the morning to take refuge and generate bodhicitta. Due to this merit, Mary soon attained the important state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful dancing gods of chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.